Real Madrid versus Barcelona under 3.5 goals. Correct. Aston Villa versus Manchester City over 3.5 goals. Incorrect. Hello, Squawker Talker listeners, and welcome back to another episode of the Squawker Talker Football Podcast, sponsored by BetBull. Our 3.5 double whammy over under accumulator special, unfortunately, ended by a mighty save by Claudio Bravo in the EFL Cup final. But we were correct about El Clasico being a cagey affair in which Real Madrid leapfrogged Barcelona to go top of La Liga. But enough about the past. We're talking about present, future, but also past in terms of this last week. And joining me on our journey of time is chief writer at Squawker, Mohamed Butt. Welcome.
How you doing? Thibaut Courtois, very good now, Clasico.
Very good. Better than Ter Stegen.
Better than pretty much everyone right now, mate.
Ooh. But we won't dive into it because we have the richest content man in the world. Sam Long, rich content editor.
How's it going?
I always forget to say your title, so I double checked it and I remembered that it was one of my favourites. So there you go. Full name.
Thank
introduction.
You.
Welcome. And finally, the loudest voice in the podcast business, chief editor at Squawker, Will Hall. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
No problem at all. Yeah. And my name, that's one I always notice. I forget to say that I'm Jake Entwistle, if you want to know. And we're going to dive straight into what has been a painful week for Liverpool FC. On Saturday, the chances of going unbeaten, matching the mighty Invincibles, was ended at the hands of Watford. And then, in the FA Cup, Chelsea, inspired by 18-year-old sensation Billy Gilmore, ended not only their chance of a treble-winning season, but potentially the career of a Brazilian midfielder. That is a note that I have on my agenda here. So maybe we lean on that. Where did that Billy Gilmore performance come from first? We'll start with him, the star of the show, and rightly highlighted by Frank Lampard afterwards as being one of the best players on the pitch. 18 years old.
Oh, he's just absolutely incredible. And you look at Lampard's comments afterwards, you'd think he would be a bit, you would expect maybe to be a bit more, oh, it was good from the kid, he played well. He was just like, no, he's that good. He trains, that's how good he is in training. I've played him because he is that good. Lampard's always very matter-of-fact about his young players and tells it like it is sometimes. You know, and I think he was just, yeah, look, he's that good. He's brilliant. He can do a bit of everything. He did a bit of everything. And, you know, and then to was like, oh, with suspension and the injury now, and he played, like, yeah, he will play. He wasn't like, oh, we'll see. He was like, yeah, he'll play.
On several occasions, Lampard has now been very keen to stress that he almost disregards the age of players when picking them. Yeah. And when speaking about Billy Gilmore, and a couple, maybe once before his post-match press conference in the last one, as you referred to, he was saying he's picked because of how he trains, how he plays, and how he behaves.
Yeah, and you can see that he was sensational. It wasn't just the passing, which you'd expect him to do well. He dribbled well. He tackled well. There was a moment where he chased back into his own blocks to block Mane. I was like, wow. Mm. Like it was genuinely like a top quality all-around performance. If it had been De Bruyne doing that or Bernardo Silva or Pogba or something, you'd have been like, yeah, like that's absolutely top quality performance.
Yeah. But everyone did say it was top quality.
No, but that's what I'm saying. It's just like this genuinely, you know, it's amazing how good he was. And the idea that if he could even carry, obviously, you know, consistency is the key at young age. Can he do that consistently? We don't know. We haven't seen him yet. If he can do it even semi-consistently, that's a phenomenal midfielder for Chelsea to have, because they've got Jorginho, very good. They've got, although Alan Shearer went a bit overboard saying that Gilmore does things Jorginho doesn't. All right, steady on, Alan. Jorginho, very good. Kovacic, very good. Kante doesn't really fit the system. So you need a third guy. And if Gilmore can be that third guy, that's huge for Chelsea. Because right now, they have to play Jorginho and Kovacic every game. And that eventually has resulted in Kovacic's injury. They can now bring Gilmore into that rotation. That's going to make their midfield so much sharper.
I haven't seen Jorginho nutmeg Fabinho like Billy Gilmore did.
That's true. That is true. But then also I haven't seen Gilmore take a lovely hot penalty.
Give him time. He's only 18.
Yeah, that's true.
Penalties don't mean anything, remember, anyway.
He's actually played for Chelsea's under-23s this season as well in the Football League Trophy. So, I mean, it's a hell of a rise, really.
Hmm. And we'll move from Billy Gilmore to the person that was exposed Will's been waiting to do this for ages and ages and ages. But to actually bring a level of seriousness to it, that was a Lampard impression to an extent.
But no, seriously.
Mentioning Fabinho there, obviously has come back from his injury and not been as impressive. That's been sort of a wide-ranging view. It's not something that has been held specifically by Will or by us in any means. But you've looked into why he's maybe struggled coming back, or if there's actually a trend to his performances being linked to Liverpool's lesser performances.
I do want to be careful about how I frame this, because jokingly I wrote down on the agenda time to get rid of Fabinho, basically. But I want to caveat this right up top by saying, in Liverpool's best team, Fabinho has that place in central defensive midfield. And I think going back to just before his injury, Gary Neville was describing him as the best defensive midfielder in... I think he used the word around, which could even mean Premier League, or it could mean in Europe. And then when the injury happened, it was... there were many people making the point that this is something that could seriously derail Liverpool's season because of all their chances of going unbeaten, in fact, because of how important he was to the team. But we also know that Fabinho is a player who took a long time to be integrated into the first team. And as much as you can say that's a Jurgen Klopp thing, his initial performances looked a bit ropey. Some of that is going to have to do with this languid style of play that we've discussed previously. But if you go back across the three defeats out of Liverpool's last four games, his fingerprints are kind of on all but one of the goals Liverpool have conceded.
Oh, Inspector Gadget in the wrong way.
And in some instances, in a manner that's unfortunate for him and not necessarily something he can take the blame for. But it's his miscued clearance, and this one maybe falls under the unfortunate bracket, but it is his miscued clearance at the corner that eventually finds its way to Saul to score the opener in the 1-0 defeat to Atletico Madrid. If you watch him for Watford's opener...
And you were closely.
He starts the throw-in marking Doucouré, who slips in behind and crosses the ball in across the six-yard box for Saar to finish. Lovren kind of has Deeney in a full Nelson for the third time of the game, so he's preoccupied. But then Fabinho kind of lets Doucouré run. That drags Van Dijk out of place, and Saar pops in and scores. And then after the goal, Fabinho's reaction is kind of to throw his arms up in exasperation and then turns around and can't really quite work out how to blame. And it's ultimately like a miscommunication across all the players in the box. But it's also his failed headed clearance that finds its way to Will Hughes. And this is another unfortunate one because it stays in by a hair down the byline after Will Hughes back heels it past Fabinho and Deeney sets Saar on one-on-one. Unfortunately, can't blame him for the third one because that's all Trent Alexander-Arnold. But then again, in the Chelsea defeat, he's not quite ready for the fast restart that Adrian executes by throwing the ball out wide. Miscontrols the ball, it winds up at Willian's feet, and obviously the second part of that goal is Adrian's failure to make the save. But that gets Chelsea on their way, puts them in a position where they don't have to be quite so advanced, and the onus is on Liverpool to equalise. Then later in the game, because he's just been booked for a foul on Mason Mount, he can't hack Ross Barkley when he's running through the middle, and you can see him track like chasing Ross Barkley down. He almost like goes to do so, and then remembers he's on the yellow. So
I think you called all of those unfortunate in the end. So it sounds.
This
like...
is the thing. So this is why I was trying to be careful with how I frame it, because he's associated with all those goals. He's not necessarily at fault for all those goals, but he in certain cases failed to intervene in a way that you'd expect from a defensive midfielder of his quality. Mm-hmm. And so the offshoot of this is, if you're Jurgen Klopp, you might. You're going to be thinking about rushing Henderson back for the second leg against Atletico Madrid potentially.
Why not play Chiarella? He was very impressive every time he played. And he's not actually like a teenager. Yeah. He's like 23 or something.
Yeah. So. He's also third choice in the pecking order.
Yeah, but I mean, look, Fabinho is like disastrous. I mean, even my son was like... Right now, he's playing terribly. Look, I've been a big proponent of his. I'm a big fan of his. But right now, he's not playing well. I mean, look at the Chelsea guy. The first mistake was such... I mean, okay, he's unfortunate. Adrian just lets the shot in, like right at him. But even my son was like, what are you doing, Fabinho? Because like, he just completely miscontrols a simple pass.
But yeah.
It's like, it's shocking.
I think, one, that would be incredibly... If Chiarovella plays in the Champions League, that would be like... That would be the end of Fabinho. Like, that would show no sign of confidence at all. So that's maybe reactive. The point I was going to make is... Perhaps it has recentered the debate on Jordan Henderson being so important because, as you said, when Fabinho was injured, it was like, oh no, how will we ever cope? Then Henderson went back into that role and Liverpool didn't concede for 8 games in the Premier League.
Yeah. There's other factors at play, of course. Joe Gomez stepped into the defence for those and he's one player who was absent for the Watford game. Dejan Lovren probably took more stick than anyone for that defeat. But yeah, I think maybe also another part of the issue is that Henderson provides Fabinho a bit more security when he's there. It could be to do with their partnerships. And ultimately, it's just about when you've got a consistent starting 11, the chemistry is just so much better
When he's coming back from injury as well, Klopp might have, if Henderson was fit, then he would have. Fabinho might not have played as many minutes, but he's almost forced his hand that he has to play because Henderson's out.
And as well, this is all Fabinho may be making these mistakes that are having a minor or major part in the goals that are being conceded. In these 3 defeats, Liverpool have not scored.
Yes, that's true, and they haven't looked like scoring.
Exactly,
like the Watford game, it was just a lot of people were commenting that like when they went 2-0, even when they went 2-0 down, they're like, I don't know how they're going to do it, but Liverpool are probably going to win this game still because of this reputation they've established over the course of the season for being mentality monsters. But yeah, they just didn't look like they got anywhere near in the Chelsea game as well. Like, I think it was 4 minutes added on, and Chelsea players were going down with cramp, but. Don't really need to because they just weren't threatening at all.
What shocked me most about the Chelsea game was okay, fine, Mane had an off day shooting wise and everything, but what shocked me most was when Salah and Firmino came on, Liverpool didn't suddenly up a gear. It was so strange to see because you're thinking, all right, you're bringing Firmino on, he's changed so many games coming off the bench. Salah is obviously world class. This will be, at least you'll think there'll be a siege on Kepa's goal, right? It wasn't even a siege. It was like, Salah, I think, had one shot and it was like really wasn't effective. Firmino didn't affect the game at all. And it was just, that was the strangest thing for me because, okay, fine, you can have Mane having a bad day at the office. That happens to any player. You know, but
I thought Mane was all right.
Yeah, he nailed 3 shots on target, which is usually enough to beat Kepa this season. So he did what we've told every team to do.
Just shoot it.
If you apply his save percentage,
I mean, he made that triple save, which was
that was when looking at that stat, he made more saves in that 1 minute than he did in his last 2 Premier League appearances, which included conceding 2 against Arsenal.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe being dropped has sort of helped him. Like maybe Willy Caballero is his Anders Lindegaard, right? So like he's had to be dropped for like a vastly inferior goalkeeper and it's sort of woken him up to the reality of the situation.
But also, it's one game. So every goalkeeper can have a world-class performance. And I think
Kepa hasn't had one of those in a long time.
Yeah, I think we can leave Liverpool-Chelsea there. Obviously, as we said, Liverpool season, all of a sudden, despite how dominant they have been in the Premier League, there's... now an underwhelming air and I've seen sort of conflict between Liverpool fans of being like, wait, hold on, we're still going to win the title, which we've been waiting for 30 years. Yeah. This is a good season versus, but it promised so much more. Yeah. So
I mean, when that title gets confirmed, though, it's going to, I think
when,
everyone's...
If.
well, this is the thing, is it?
Well, the whole atmosphere is going to change.
Yeah, but we'll leave Liverpool-Chelsea there. In terms of FA Cup stuff, we're recording before Man United face Derby. They will be facing Norwich in the quarterfinal, which we wanted to focus not necessarily on the full game, but obviously Tim Krul's water bottle has since gone viral after more penalty shootout heroics, which he himself has become famous for, previously being substituted on in the 121st minute in a World Cup to then lead Netherlands through against Costa Rica. But the water bottle was the viral moment, but there was some discussion off air about antics and whether he should be allowed to play up to the spectacle of a penalty shootout that much. So beyond the actual game in which Spurs didn't impress, Jose Mourinho lamented the fixture, his lack of fit players. A similar theme, we don't need to delve too much into that. But just to round up the FA Cup section, perhaps, I know Mo and Sam had particular thoughts.
Theatricality and deception are powerful agents to the uninitiated. Tim Krul is bane. He was just proper hamming it up in front of the penalty spot, getting in all their heads. He said to Parrott, "I've seen all your penalties, mate. I know which way you're going to go." He completely got in his head. He just completely went full
super villain. Well done, mate. He's 18.
Obviously, it was really... It's like the kind of thing where you look at objectively, you're thinking, why are you winding up an 18-year-old? Aren't you like 33? But it's one of those things. It's pure supervillainy in a football field. It's like it's really getting in everyone's heads. It's playing up to the underdog card. It's messing with Chelsea, with Spurs players. And Spurs had to be also low on confidence because they should have won that game. Like the amount of domination they had for the last hour of it, last half an hour of the match and then last hour of extra time. It's crazy they didn't score a goal. But, I think Krul, I thought it was fantastic. It was pure pantomime. It's what you want to see in football. You want to just see someone really push it and be... Because he wasn't actually hurting anybody. That's the first thing. You know, you don't want to ever hurt people.
It's unsportsmanlike conduct, my friend.
That's football. Half of football is full of that, mate. That's
No, I just think that the referee should get a grip on it in that situation. He's wasting time before every single penalty. Coming off his line, getting in the player's face. I mean, of course, you can see why... He did it and it worked perfectly, but I just think the referee should get a handle on it.
Yeah, he was off his line for every penalty. I'm surprised they didn't clamp down on that at least. If not the unsportsmanlike stuff, at least the fact that he's taking a step off his line before diving for every penalty.
I think the point Sam's making there is like try it once, but it was quite strange to see him get away with it. So psych out the first person or try and do that.
If you flip it onto the other side, if the player who walks up with the ball waits for the player to get. Waits for the goalkeeper to assume his like starting position before he puts the ball down, then the player would be told to hurry up. You wouldn't be able to do that, would you, if you walked up and took a minute while Krul walked around and sort of took the advantage back to you, as it were? Then the ref would call it up, so the goalkeeper should be called up in the same way.
Yeah, I think it's because the goalkeepers, again, the sort of point I mentioned off earlier was that they live, these their moments in which they won't be lamented for making errors or spilling. They can't do anything wrong in these situations. And everything they do is an attempt to make sure that they win the game for their team. And they're not put in that position usually. So it's that balance of giving them the spotlight and letting them take it, but also... potentially that was too much.
Yeah. Shout out Todd Campbell, by the way. That was a fantastic performance. When you list his position, he was just everywhere. He was defending, he was tracking back, he was defending normally, pushing forward, running beyond the forwards, linking play. He did absolutely everything. That was a phenomenal performance. And his penalty was amazing.
Yeah, and then planted it top corner. Adam Eder as well, 18-year-old striker for Norwich. His penalty was in top bins as well.
Very confident.
Will, did you have a point to make
I was just going to say, for a goalkeeper, it's just everything to gain and really nothing to lose. Yeah. And in fact, I think I remember reading a study a couple of years ago about the maths behind penalty taking a penalty, how do you increase your chances of success? Yeah. You're the goalkeeper wanting to save it. And I think the longer between putting the ball down, the whistle being blown, and the penalty taker shooting, the likelihood of missing goes up. So if you can just increase... and that's about... because all the pressure is on the striker, so the longer you can keep the striker in that state...
That's exactly what I'm talking about in terms of putting the ball down. Yeah, if you wait, then it's you... The chances with you, isn't it?
That's how I was amazed Bruno Fernandes scored is at the weekend. He had to wait like 3 minutes for a VAR review. He was standing there in front of the thing and actually...
Cool, I found a way to get some sort of positive Bruno Fernandes when he's coming up later. So due to Tim Krul's antics or heroics, whichever side of the fence you're on, Norwich are in their first quarterfinal since 1992. Joining them, and we have the odds here of FA Cup winners from this morning on the BetBall app, Man City are favourites at 8-11. Chelsea second favourites 8-1. Manchester United, who of course haven't even beaten Derby yet.
Played Derby.
But in the sense that they'd be further favourites to win and they haven't even secured one of the wins they need. 9-1. Arsenal 10-1, who obviously went through against Portsmouth. Sheffield United, who Arsenal will play at Bramall Lane, 20-1. And Newcastle 40-1. And Norwich way beyond. And perhaps a risky number. Do we have any thoughts on to round this section off then of who will be the winners.
I mean, it's probably City now, isn't it? Right? I mean, they're all really one of the best teams, or the second best team this season, best team in terms of football quality and everything. But with Liverpool out, who's going to stop them? That's why I thought it was a mistake for Klopp to not go full strength against Chelsea, because first of all, he would have righted their season after the Watford loss, which he did. He did this last season against Wolves, by the way, put out a B team in the cup, and then they went on that run where Mane was rescuing them from losing games. They drew like four games and threw away a 6-point lead to 1 point behind, which they lost the league by. So I'm afraid he's made the same mistake again. And also, they could have won the cup. They've got City's number. City are afraid of them. No one else in the country is even close to them anyway. Like, they could have won a treble. They genuinely could have won the treble. And it's like, they just sort of gave up. And
I think if this week's reminders of anything, it's that, like, forecasting trebles and invincible seasons when you're in the moment at which those records and possibilities are still alive.
Yeah.
Well, this is an easy thing to do, and just like one game can just totally confound it. It reminds you how impressive those achievements are, really.
Also, the other team that went through is Leicester, which I forgot to mention there. They've obviously had their own dip. Vardy being injured therefore means that their overperformance of expected goals has also declined, with him not being on the pitch and not firing himself. So they might be now clinging on to this, but they're also wrestling for that Champions League place. So
and they did choke in the EFL Cup, didn't they? Against Villa.
Exactly. Man City, as you mentioned, now looking for their own sort of domestic treble again. A different treble. Looking to secure Champions
treble.
Looking to score Champions League, rather than they can't. Well, we don't think they can win the Premier League.
It wouldn't be the Mickey Mouse treble at Liverpool's. It would be the, I don't know, Donald Duck treble.
What's the Mickey? What's
the Europa, Liverpool won the Europa League, the FA Cup, and
the UEFA Cup.
Sorry, it was and then the League Cup and the FA Cup, and everyone called it a Mickey Mouse treble.
Liverpool can technically win a treble this season.
Not
as well.
Everyone called it the Mickey Mouse treble.
Well, certain fan bases called it Mickey Mouse treble, and which is unfair because it was very impressive.
But they've won a treble. This they will have Super Cup, Club World Cup, and Premier League, and they could even have quadruple.
That's a minor treble, but yeah.
But now we continue our journey through time from past into future. And we're going to be... Oh, no. I've just realised...
We're sticking with the past.
We are actually going to be sticking on the past because...
This is about to be a history lesson.
Because ahead of the Manchester Derby, which is the biggest game this weekend in the Premier League, we're going to be doubling down analysis, focus, as Will said as well. Also, history lessons on this fixture to an extent. The first of which to paint the picture, to tell the story. We're going to be looking at how Old Trafford turned blue last season.
Right. So if you think Manchester City supplanting United as the Premier League's most dominant team during the last decade is the most significant trend in English football, then this particular fixture symbolises that more than any other. Because I was asking you guys off air, like how familiar with City's recent record, Old Trafford, are you? And I guess a good way of gauging that would be with a little pop trivia question. Since Manchester United lost 6-1 to City at Old Trafford,
good times.
How many games do you think they've won in the Premier League in this fixture? So Premier League games against Manchester City at Old Trafford since then.
Six.
I was going to say five. Yeah.
The answer is one.
I was literally about to say one.
Oh right, yeah. So obviously I didn't think they'd won. I was thinking Man City wins.
Okay.
Let me just be clear, because that sounds like I'm really wrong.
Well, you're pretty close actually. I think the answer might be five, but I find that quite shocking. And if you look over the whole of the last decades, the 2010s, Manchester United won just two of their games at Old Trafford out of a possible nine. And for the sake of balance, we are just talking about this particular fixture at Old Trafford now. Mm. But the Manchester Derby is weird because the second component of this is that United have won, I think, three of their last four games at the Etihad. So as much as you can say that City have moved into Old Trafford, The reverse is also true.
A stadium swap.
And also, I mean, interestingly, their recent Carabao Cup semi-final, two-legged semi-final, was pretty much encapsulated this trend with City winning the leg at Old Trafford, ultimately the win that matters, where but Manchester United salvaged some pride. Now, Mo, you say you were right in the answer to that question. So let's put that to the test and see if you can remember what the one game they've won.
Right, it was. Since. And with a quick, this is a podcast format, so time to speed while you wait for Mo to
While you think, I'll do a bit of tap dancing for you.
I'll go on.
The win came courtesy of a goal and two assists from Ashley Young.
Goals are usually scored to win games.
That's true.
Goal and two assists from Ashley Young.
I know. But as you started the sentence, come on, let's have a guess now. It doesn't matter if you're wrong, but this is a podcast.
It's 3-2, wasn't it? It was the... Oh God, I can't remember.
Yeah. So
I can't remember.
I think the reason you can't remember is because it was so long ago. It was 5 years. It's been 5 years since United beat them in the Premier League Old Trafford. It was 4-2, and had they lost that game, City would have become the first team to win five consecutive games against United in Premier League history. That's according to 11v11, the website 11v11. Their only other win in this fixture during the 2010s came right at the start of the decade with the first Manchester derby at Old Trafford of the decade. It was the overhead kick scored by Wayne Rooney.
Nanny and Rooney.
Nanny was had quite a good record against City.
Brace against them in the Community Shield.
Community Shield, yeah. And then the subsequent meeting at Old Trafford is, of course, that 6-1 defeat, which is United's heaviest defeat
why
in Premier League history.
Why
always me, of course, yeah. It's just
I love Mo's little interjections
but I think the thing that highlights is that when I was going back through these results, you just forget how many iconic moments in Premier League history. Like, this is the fixture for me that's just defined the decade because of all this mad stuff that's gone on in it. Like 6-1, and you can sometimes forget that. I mean, that was under Sir Alex Ferguson.
The last one of the previous decade was, I do believe, the 4-3 when Michael Owen scored in the last second. That was 9-10. So I think that was the last one of the last decade as well.
I chose to research specifically this decade. I can't help you with that.
Yes.
And so that win kickstarted a run during which they won six of their top flight games as visitors against United. The third of which in March 2014 actually saw them rock up Old Trafford as favourites to win that game, favourites with bookmakers to win that game for the first time in Premier League history. They would win it 3-0 with Edin Dzeko scoring twice. And so that's kind of like the midpoint of the decade where the supplanting of United is like is in process and nearly complete. And I think one game that symbolises a total sort of outstripping of United as a Premier League rival is their last trip, which ended in a 2-0 win to City. It actually kind of paved the way for them to win the title because I think it was like one of their few tough fixtures remaining in the season when they were being hunted down by Liverpool. That ended 2-0. And going into it, it was the longest odds for United to win a Premier League game at Old Trafford in Premier League history.
Yeah.
They were 13-2 to win.
The turning of the rivalry came. Ferguson retired 2013. Man City won the title, came back to win the title the next season, including beating United at Old Trafford, I do believe. And that was it. That was when it turned. It was they sort of pulled up level with United, and then that happened, and it just turned. And United have been in their shadow since then, really.
But winning the odd game at the Etihad,
exactly.
As you
said. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not been complete total domination because they've been able to just cultivate this strong record, which has also resulted in quite iconic Premier League moments.
Marcus Rashford
rinsing Dino Kalis. I think that was like he set some kind of record for youngest.
He's the
Manchester
youngest
derby scorer in that game. That was hot off the back of his Europa League antics as well, I believe.
And his Arsenal antics.
Yeah,
but also a couple of seasons ago, there was the win at Old Trafford that delayed the coronation of City with Pogba, which kind of came out of nowhere.
Was that the Etihad?
Because we're obviously talking now about how the reverse of this is true. Going into this upcoming game with BetBull, Manchester United 9-2 to win, City are favourites 4-7, draws 10-3. But I just think we forget that there was a time when it was unthinkable that anyone would visit Old Trafford and be favourites to win.
So thanks to Will Hall, we now know exactly how and when Manchester became blue and bald, because Pep Guardiola was the first manager to win three consecutive Premier League games at Old Trafford.
Also
worth
the first
a mention.
Bald manager to win the Premier League.
Yes, which is any loyal Scorker followers will know is a famous, based off a famous tweet once done. But if Manchester United need to now wrestle back the keys to the city, Mo and Sam have been tasked with discussing the key points in a rebuild. And I want to start with you, Mo, straight away. What is considered to be the most pressing need at Old Trafford in terms of reverting this Old Trafford dominance that Man City have over them?
I don't think it's pressing, but the most divisive one is do you need a new coach? Because there's the whole idea, when United were playing badly, which they have done for a lot of time this season, it's Solskjaer's not good enough. He's not good enough. He's not smart enough. He makes bad decisions, this. And when United play well, that sort of talk has died down a little bit, but I don't know if it... The arguments behind it, I don't think have gone away. I think it's just the fact that I think you need to stick with him for two reasons. One is, I think he engenders such goodwill to the club among the fans. It's really, you know, you keep the fans aside. But also, I think more than actually that they should keep him, I think they just will keep him. Like, there's no point to like, oh, United should go for Poch, United should go for this guy, Ralph Ragnick, whoever. United aren't going to do that. They've got themselves a human bulletproof shield in order to go Solskjaer. He stands up for the owners constantly. He asks for things, tries to push the club forward, but not so much that he's like going to come out and say these guys are rubbish. He's not like Conte, like coming out and actively saying they're not supporting me. Oh, what the hell's going on here? He gets on with it, does his job. He's a club legend, so he just engenders good PR. He does talk a good game, and he's not completely useless. You know,
you have just basically described a yes man there, though.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, and that you've changed your own tune quite. By a few notes, I reckon we could go back and listen to it.
Would you say he's improved in the job, though?
Yeah.
I can't remember what player it was who came out. I think Matic.
It was Matic that said he's improving every day. I think he has. And I think,
which is a really weird thing for a player to say about a manager, by the way.
It is very strange. But, you know, Matic is very honest. Like, he was like, yeah, look, I'm here. If they want to renew me, I'm right here. They can just contact me. I'll just keep doing my job otherwise. He was a very forthright guy. But yeah, I think Solskjaer is improving. I think you do stick with him because I just think United are going to stick with him. So I almost don't want to dedicate any brain power to thinking about who they could replace him with, because they're not going to do it.
If they are behind
him. Stop the recording. No brain power needed.
If they are behind him and it looks like the reports coming out of the club are that they are going to stick with him, that's all well and good. But he's not going to be Man United manager in 5 years' time, I would argue. Even if they're saying they're going to stick with him for the long term, he's not going to do... six plus
even if he
years
was doing
charge.
Really well at this current moment, then I don't think necessarily that was the case given the current climate of managerial turnover across big clubs generally.
Yeah, so and I think the fact that he won't be there for that long highlights what they need to get right behind the scenes, which is recruitment and strategy. They've lurched from one model to the other since Ferguson's retired, and they struggled to adapt to what a lot of other elite clubs had to do sort of 10, 15, 20 years ago, and that is adapt to the fact that the managers will come and go, but the club has to constantly be at it. You look at how Chelsea have managed to cope with that. A manager leaves halfway through the season, but the show has to go on. Man United don't have Ferguson there to pick up the phone and woo a player anymore. They have to have a bit more about them. But they have the wages, they have the facilities, and they have the history and the prestige. So something is going very wrong when you're scrambling around to sign Odion Ighalo, when at the start of the window you were going for Erling Haaland. And David Ornstein of The Athletic has reported that United's backroom staff is set for a bit of a shake-up, with up to 8 new members of staff coming in to help identify talent through the use of data. Now, that seems like it's a step in the right direction, and would appear that the next step after that would be the appointment of a director of football or a technical director, however you want to sort of word it. And obviously that model's got a lot of column inches because Liverpool and Man City have used it so well. But on the other hand, those appointments that they're bringing in, those 8 members of staff, you could argue that they've done it the wrong way, because if they bring them in and then they look to appoint a director of football afterwards, then that person might come in and decide that he wants to change the people beneath him. So they kind of feel like they've taken a step in the right direction, but I think it's the same sort of criticisms of they need to make a decision and stick to it. They're still potential for a year, 2 years down the line, that they change tact again. They just need to decide what they're going to be. And I think that's the biggest thing that they've struggled really since Ferguson left, is they've got everything in place, but they don't have this figurehead anymore. But then they're struggling to adapt to not have that figurehead.
I think everything in place is exactly right. I think if you look at where United are, they're right now, they're miles off the top. But at the same time, it's obviously they need, for long-term health, they need to sort the backroom staff out. But in terms of short-term, because the short-term, long-term can only really be birthed from short-term success as well. That's what I mean. That's what Guardiola is always going on about Man City. Like, I'm only here because I keep winning trophies. That's why they keep buying me. They're going to sack me one day. So the short-term thing is United are kind of a mess right now, but they're like four signings away from actually being really good. The building blocks are there. You've seen Bruno Fernandes already come in and hugely improve the team. And you look at the... and. There's about five more signings they need to make, really, to really sort of take this team to the next level. I know it's a lot of signings, but yeah. they've needed to make them for a while. They've just been neglecting them. So the right wing is the first one they need to make, because you look at United's right side, for years it's been in steady decline. Valencia was amazing 10 years ago. It's basically been in decline since that. Since 9-10, when he had that great season with Rooney linking up, and they just never addressed it after that, and they've been declining and declining. And Mata's not a right winger. Like, he just isn't. And Jesse Lingard's not a right winger. They don't have one. They're targeting Jadon Sancho, which is hugely ambitious. And I still think that contingent on Champions League football. If they don't get Champions League football, I don't think there's any way he comes to Old Trafford. If they can do it, hey, that's something we've seen him. He's a phenomenal talent.
They're also linked with Jack Grealish, though. I read recently that he was the main target.
This is what I was going to say. He's the attacker. They need a right winger, a striker, attacking midfielder, left back, and a defensive midfielder. Attacking midfielder, I think, is Jack Grealish. I think it was Grealish and Maddison. They were looking at both of them. I think they're settled on Grealish, which I think is partly because they expect Villa to get relegated. He'll be cheaper. I mean, it's just my guess. But also, he kind of does fit Solskjaer a bit more, because he's a bit more anarchic than Maddison. You feel like Maddison maybe needs a bit more of a stronger coach, a bit more of a system to play in. Whereas you look at Grealish, and I think he can play in a system, but also he can play off the cuff, he can play left, can play attacking midfield. I don't quite know how you fit Grealish and Bruno Fernandes into the same team with Marcus Rashford. But at the same time,
but not your problem.
No.
That's exactly it, though. So they're signing. They're being linked to all the names, but they're still not going after the right.
No, but this is what I was going to say. The thing with Grealish is, I don't think it makes sense in terms of starting 11. You want to improve your starting 11. I do understand it, because right now, United's backup left winger is who? It's the Paul Martial, their striker, out to left wing. United's backup right winger is, the starting right winger is Dan James. Their backup number 10 is 32-year-old Juan Mata, who looks like he can play once every five games, play really well, and that's it. Or Jesse Lingard. Like, their squad depth in attack is non-existent. So they almost need to overspend on someone like Jack Grealish, and then they can have this sort of rotating forward. Like, it probably won't last for a season, but it will give them enough of a boost that they can then maybe go look at actual young players.
Their squad is still just a complete mishmash of different bits and bobs.
In attack, I think
managers.
So. I think in midfield and in defence, it's starting to coalesce. You can see they need a left back. That's the one thing I will say. They need a left back. Aaron Wan-Bissaka has the talent to already be his defensive self, but push forward and attack and grow as attacker. But left back, they have Luke Shaw, who just looks like a ghost. The ghost of Luke Shaw is
left back.
He was
nominated for their Player of the Month.
Yeah, I don't understand that, because he's okay. This is the thing, he's 7 out of 10, but it's like he's never going to give you more than 7 out of 10. And when your right back is Wan-Bissaka, who isn't like the most prolific attacker, he can do it, but he's not the most prolific one. You need your left back to really be a constant source of creativity, especially if you're going to be having Rashford and Grealish or someone playing on the left that are going to cut inside. You want someone that's going to be constantly bombing down the left of them.
Maybe they should sign Target as
I mean,
well.
Ben Chilwell is the one I would suggest. Matt Target or Ryan Bertrand, decent backups, I guess. But
these are like, because they're English and already Premier League talents, these are like £60 million signings, all of them.
Yeah, and they need a defensive midfielder as well. That's where I think they can look abroad. They can look to someone like Thomas Partey, who has a £42 million release clause, which I think would be a fantastic purchase, because they need an actual defensive midfielder. McTominay's an 8, Fred's an 8, Bruno Fernandes is a 10. You need an actual defensive holding midfielder who can play with intelligence and quality and physicality. Thomas Partey is that. And then they need a striker, because, I mean, I saw a report that they're considering a permanent move for Ole Ngalo, and they're just going to make the same mistake they made with Solskjaer. Like you were saying, when Solskjaer was there as an interim manager, you're like, let him ride out the season interim manager and then let him go.
Has he not been all right, though?
But this is the point. He's okay as a loan emergency signing. He's doing well now because he's on loan. He's looking to impress. He loves Man United. If you sign him permanently, then he's that settled. And then the fact that he's not actually that good is going to become a major issue. like, he's fine for this current emergency situation, coming in and covering for everyone, but you want to sign an actual centre forward. Like,
of those positions, do you think there's any in which United don't necessarily need to look to the transfer market to fill? Like, is there any like youth team players coming up that
you don't believe Mason Greenwood's good enough to actually be player?
Greenwood's not a nine though; he's still too young. I think Greenwood, you could.
Let me just use this as a platform. Jadon Sancho has proven himself to be pretty much a world-class winger. His output is world-class this season. He is 19 years old, was born in the year 2000. Yeah. Greenwood was born in the year 2001.
Yeah.
The only way that Jadon Sancho became this good is because he was played.
Yeah.
Why does that mean... Does Mason Greenwood need to go on loan? Does he need to leave Manchester United like Jadon Sancho left Man City to become good? Or why is he not perceived as good enough if they're about to spend $100 million on a 19-year-old? Why is the 18-year-old not good enough to be considered the backup striker to Martial?
It's not about quality. I think it's more about style, the way he plays. Greenwood is an elite goal scorer. Like, you can see it in him. He's already got the talent.
That's usually a good thing for a striker.
It's a very good thing, but it's just the all-around game, playing up front as a nine. I've seen him, he can get lost a few times. Maybe it's a loan. Maybe you sack off signing a striker. Maybe you don't sign that. They've been linked with Moussa Dembele or Arkadiusz Milik. Maybe you don't sign those guys, and maybe you just bring Greenwood through and say, if you've got Sancho supplying you, then suddenly your creativity goes up a whole notch. Grealish, Sancho, Bruno Fernandes. Maybe then you can just put Greenwood.
So this is exactly what I mean in terms of they need to decide
on
a strategy. If they're going to still spend big and throw money at, then they need to do it. If they're going to put faith in the people who they have, who are on the sort of cusp of breakthroughs like Greenwood, then they need to do it. But they need to decide either way.
Because what I would say is quick analysis of squad-wise.
Yeah.
I understand, yes, they do need to buy an elite winger. And as I said, Sancho's established. I'm not disputing that. Mm. But then you have Marcus Rashford, Dan James, Mason Greenwood, Jadon Sancho. That's four wingers.
Is Greenwood a winger? Is he a striker?
This is what you've just told me, that he doesn't have the capability to play number nine.
But
how does he gain those capabilities?
Yeah, that's true.
If you're buying Moussa Dembele, who is 23, he's not. So yeah, I agree. He is established, has done well at Lyon, but you are taking away Mason Greenwood's minutes. The more of these ready-made stars, I would always say buy under 25-year-olds. I'm not disputing this. But Mason Greenwood, by all we know, is this prestigious, supernatural goal scorer.
Do you know what it is?
He will not get any minutes if more part signings are made.
That's
in those
true. Do you know what actually? Do you know what it is? It feeds back to Sam's point about Solskjaer. I think Greenwood needs a proper coach, like a really good coach. I think if you look at him, like you're saying, he doesn't know how to play nine. He's 18. But I think that's just a lot of that is tactical. And I think if you get like a proper coaching, like not Solskjaer, or you just get an attacking coach to work with him, he can learn that. Because it's not that he doesn't have the ability.
What's Thierry Henry doing?
Yeah, I mean, you know.
or managing Montreal Impact.
Actually, Mason Greenwood wouldn't like him at all, because I noticed from looking at his shot maps that he's actually developing a bit of a trademark of when he cuts inside, rather than conventionally going across the goalkeeper, which Thierry Henry made famous. Or he didn't make famous, but has become synonymous with the inside of the foot curl to the bottom corner. Greenwood reverses a lot, so perhaps there'd be loads of arguments in training anyway.
It's the anti-Henri.
Yes, that's exactly what I put in the tweet this morning. Yeah, but the Greenwood thing, again, I'm not saying he should be their number nine. Rashford, we've said, is better on the left wing because he cuts in and scores goals. Why isn't Mason Greenwood the right winger?
Well, I think
the goal-scoring right winger.
I don't think he has the pace to be the electric pace. I think he's very tricky and he reminds me more of. He reminds me of Aguero in many ways. Like, he's short, he's quite strong, he's got good movement, but he's not like going to win a foot race against anybody. And just like Aguero, it's kind of hard to fit him into a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-3-3 sometimes. And you need to have very creative wingers. Mm. So I think maybe adding Bruno Fernandes, adding Jadon Sancho, or anyone, any right winger that actually genuinely creative, not Juan Mata or Andres Pereira.
Mata is genuinely
creative. I love Mata,
creative.
But it's one in five games.
I'm not saying that he should be there now, but Sam, do you have anything to add before we do too much Mason Greenwood debate?
Yeah, I was going to move it on from Man United and look at another angle, which is that as much as Man United are looking to close the gap, Man City could be braced for a period of decline with their Champions League ban still pending, of course, all the usual sort of avenues which they've promised to exhaust to the fullest degree, as you would expect. But yeah, so City have been building towards the sort of end game of Champions League success to truly say, yes, we are part of Europe's elite for several years now. And if they do get banned, then that's going to do a lot of damage to the foundations that they've laid. Now, understandably, plenty of players will be reconsidering their futures if they are told you are not going to be able to play in the Champions League till 2022.
Sterling already has, hasn't he, with that Real Madrid quote?
Well, yeah, it almost. He didn't say it in as many words, did he? Like, not quite. But yeah, so I looked at some of the players who are out of contract at Man City. So David Silva, Claudio Bravo, and to a much lesser extent, Scott Carson, are free agents at the end of the season.
They might have to keep him.
Yeah, Scott Carson's going to get his deal with me, reckon.
And then, so 2021, it's Sane, Aguero, and Fernandinho. And it's not until 2023... when sort of Sterling, De Bruyne, Jesus, Mahrez, Mendy all come into play. So they seem future-proof to an extent with some of their best players, but then no David Silva, Aguero and Fernandinho by next season, things will be looking very different. And when you look at players such as Angelino, who's out on loan, saying that it's going to affect his future, it kind of shows you that we might be hearing a lot more about from these City players if we get further along the line in terms of the appeals and it's actually a no, you're not going to be able to play, I would expect more players to be coming out like Sterling and saying, "Cause I don't think I'm going to be here."
Yeah, because it's not about wanting to leave. It's the re-signing, isn't it? I think that's the important point to make. It's not that they would all immediately hand in a transfer request. We saw Pep sort of rally and cry that I'll be here if we were in League Two sort of thing. I imagine there's a similar mentality. But I think the issue is like, how do you renew someone's contract when they've not played Champions League football for 2 years based on their current contract? Even if the promise of it then returning, they'd be like, I've gone through the...
If you look at someone like Mahrez now, if he signed, he's only got maybe 4 years left to play in the Champions League, really. You're signing away that, aren't you? You're going to want to operate. If you're already at your peak years, okay, maybe someone like Foden would take the hit and say, okay, that's fine, I'll play my way into the team. It could even help someone like Foden get more minutes.
But Mahrez left Leicester in the first place to make sure that his prime years weren't wasted. Exactly. That quote's come back to against him.
Players first signed for City because of the money. Simple as that. Back to sort of Robinho days when they when Sheikh Mansour first took over.
I think a lot of the more recent signings would maybe say they signed to work with Guardiola as much as they
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say. So first of all, everyone signed for money, and then it was almost a guarantee of having Champions League football. But if you take that away, then people will be questioning why am I joining City? It's almost like you'd have to look at a calibre of player that teams like without shown any disrespect, teams like Arsenal or even Man United have had to go for, in that they're not that true elite bracket, but you're banking on them potentially reaching it at some point. And if they're after those sort of players but they're having to play them huge wages still, then there's a risk associated with that tactic.
Which is similar to, in terms of like Arsenal themselves, as you said, everything is discussed about the amount of wages that these players get relative to their actual quality. So a slippery slope in that regard.
And also, Guardiola is making all the right noises at the moment as well. But if it's upheld, then he could still easily decide that he wants to leave.
Of course, of course. The thing, we've discussed that bit a lot, and that's my fault for getting irate about spending £600 million in one window sort of thing, when perhaps that was what has been Man United's problem.
Spending it poorly, though. Spending it well is a big difference.
But the one thing that we agree on is that Bruno Fernandes has started really well. He ranks highly. He's been involved in more shots than any other player in the Premier League since his debut. That was a stat that we figured he'd be top of before he joined. I mentioned that he shoots or assists a shot every 14 minutes for Sporting. He's pretty much doing that now. 26 shots he's been involved with. And again, when we spoke about him joining, there was a lot of sort of like, he could be Man City's De Bruyne, in the sense that they'd be looking to him as be the chief primary playmaker.
Man United's De Bruyne.
Man United's De Bruyne. And obviously, we were going to do a big discussion about the battle of the creative midfielders. But De Bruyne, after the League Cup victory, has apparently had a back issue. And we don't know if he will potentially be fit for the Manchester derby. You like to think that it would be a bit of mind games. Obviously, probably wasn't ever going to play against Sheffield Wednesday anyway. So him missing out on that squad is not necessarily a definitive reveal about his fitness. But my sort of little bit on this was talking about... So initially was looking at them and they have very similar qualities, De Bruyne and Bruno Fernandes. You may have seen some of the graphics that we've been posting. I put out before the Squawker Talker, in the sense that Bruno Fernandes has become the main man in Man United's ability to create chances and engineer shots at goal. Number 10, almost traditionally to a sense, very central, operating more from the left, if you look at his average position, which is due to maybe cutting in and shooting. Naturally, that happens more often. Whereas De Bruyne is very much, and I think this is due to Pep Guardiola's sort of subscription to the juego de posición sort of ideals of football, in the sense that De Bruyne will very much operate in one space of a field, which is to the right, which is where he can enact his crossing simulator, David Beckham, Steven Gerrard comparisons, and since when they've been born. Bruno Fernandes has the technical capability to do that, of course, but finds himself as a number 10 rather than a number 8, which is usually you have a partner. Yeah. Which is a silver of Pep Guardiola's choice.
I find it interesting that he's drifting more to the left. I think that's partly because Rashford isn't there. Like against Everton, he drifted a lot to the left and played almost left wing at times off the left. I wonder how he would, what side he'd drift to if Rashford was there occupying that space doing his usual thing. I think it'd be quite interesting to see.
Well, but you'd hope there'd be a lot of association play between the two anyway, because there'd be the chief.
You would assume that the 1-2s Fernandes is playing. I mean, just the way he's getting everyone else to play up their game is just—it's really impressive. Like, it's a lot of playmakers are very good playmakers, but don't always necessarily lift the rest of their teammates the way that Fernandes has done. So, I'd imagine him and Rashford would be very good combination. Produce some very good combination. Him and Sancho could do the same too.
The one thing that I wanted to highlight as well, that was sort of like tongue in cheek to an extent, is that when looking at creators and fan rivalries on Twitter, obviously need to be taken with a pinch of salt, and they don't necessarily reflect everyone's actual opinions. But the one sort of quite funny comparison that I could make was the fact that I see quite often, by virtue of being a social media account manager, that when you tweet about Trent Alexander-Arnold or vice versa, people often associate him with being a merchant of many wares that include crosses, hoofing the ball, long balls. And the stat that is used to sort of back that up is the possession loss stat, which is a taboo in itself. So I just wanted to use this section to almost have a bit of discussion about that stat, when to use it, what it actually means. Because...
Soapbox, Jake, do it.
Because Trent Alexander-Arnold has played the most passes into the box since Bruno Fernandes' debut in the Premier League, which is 69. Bruno Fernandes is second with 44, and Kevin De Bruyne is third with 41. So already we have quite a clear sign that these players have an incredible output, are putting the ball in the most dangerous areas the most often, which lends itself massively to why we think Bruno Fernandes is going to be successful in the Premier League. Currently in the Premier League, De Bruyne and Trent Alexander-Arnold are the top two chance creators in the league. We can expect Fernandes to join that list in the top three next season, should Man United invest well and should they continue to pour resource into him. The interesting thing is that in Trent Alexander-Arnold's career, per 90 minutes, he loses possession, excluding clearances, 26.25 times a game, which would be alarming if used in isolation. Bruno Fernandes, who has been celebrated as a game-changing signing, the chief orchestrator of everything Man United are doing well, is losing the ball at 23.82 times per 90 minutes already this season. So for all the different criticisms of Alexander-Arnold from Manchester United fans, they need to be careful that Liverpool fans may now start giving them their own medicine, in the sense that Bruno Fernandes is their Trent Alexander-Arnold. He is the player that is being used to create from every single situation. Set pieces lends itself to giving possession away. Crossing lends itself to giving possession away. And Bruno Fernandes has been charged with doing that, of which Kevin De Bruyne is as well, at Manchester City.
I mean, Neymar and Leo Messi are two of the players that always rank highly for giving the ball away, especially Neymar. And that's not because they're bad players. It's because they're trying... When you try to... If you look at football, when you try to play through balls and everything, your pass percent, your completions are going to go down, because it's a risky endeavour. Playing through balls, playing key passes, trying to get the ball into the box. You're taking risks, and it's a low percentage chances. Think about how many goals are scored in football versus how many chances are created versus how many shots there are. It's like the idea that losing possession is a bad stat for a central midfielder, like a defensive midfielder. Like, then you're thinking, okay, because you're not creating chances if you're a defensive mid. But if you're coughing the ball up, then what's going on?
Well, you don't, but this is the point. They may be using arcing long balls. And the final bit of this stat dive, which you put your hands up if it's become way too dry and it's not interesting.
Oh, this is lovely.
But I then sort of inverted this to find out the players that were, was it possible to be an ultra creative player and not give away the possession to that extent? And the answer was pretty much no. There's a positive correlation between the amount of times you give the ball away and the chances you create. So Kevin De Bruyne operates at 3.37 chances created per 90 minutes, which is an obscene amount. And his loss of possession is 22.65. So higher chance creation, which I should mention, Trent Alexander-Arnold is 1.98 in his Premier League career. And Bruno Fernandes in his very short Premier League career is 2.01. Fernandes has actually had more shots than he's assisted shots since joining Man United, which, again, is indicative of how we described him in our...
It's also what United need.
In our description of him in previous podcasts. My sort of... This theory about maybe, I tried to sort of find a name of it, and it was sort of like chaos creation theory is what I stumbled across, because the more creative and the more risk you take, the less worried you are about losing the ball, usually means that you are more creative. However, you cannot fill one side with all of those players. You usually have one sort of chaos creator, and we've identified Man City's is De Bruyne. We've identified Man United's as Bruno Fernandes now, and Trent Alexander-Arnold is that for Liverpool. What was interesting is that I tried to find then the people that were creating the most chances but giving away the ball the fewest amount of times. So I looked at 2.5 chances created per 90 minutes, which, if you're listening and I haven't lost you, is actually more than Fernandes and Trent Alexander-Arnold are operating at anyway. So these are high-level creators, 2.5 chances created. And I sorted them by the fewest amount of losses of possession in this time. Top is Phil Foden, who is 2.68 chances created and 13.38 losses of possession. So that's already half of Alexander-Arnold, for example, but isn't taking corners.
Foden for England.
Fewer minutes, of course. You then have Chelsea's Oscar appears, because this is from 2016-17. I tried to give as much scope as possible. Again, few minutes, but we'll just glide past him. The next player is David Silva, who, as I said, is usually Kevin De Bruyne's partner in crime in those 2-8 positions. After that is Jack Grealish. And this is where my theory, when you were discussing about players, where Jack Grealish would play in a Man United team, I very much believe that 4-3-3, as we've seen, has been the dominant formation for Man City and Liverpool in them accumulating pretty much 100 points for the last three seasons. 4-2-3-1 at the moment for Man United works because, as you've said, Mo, there are potential holes in the side, and giving Bruno Fernandes the complete freedom to be the main creator in all spaces is what they need to do to earn points. If they sign someone like Jack Grealish, I would argue that Fred McTominay, whoever, would become a number six in the same way that Fernandinho or Rodri does that for Manchester City. And Jack Grealish's position in a potential Manchester United side should be alongside Bruno Fernandes in central midfield, because it provides the chance creation balance that I've said. Jack Grealish is the second most creative player from open play in the Premier League this season, behind Kevin De Bruyne. And pairing him with someone that is going to be crossing the ball, taking the corners, having those more high-risk passes, Jack Grealish provides you with an extremely reliable creative source that is also safer, in the sense that he usually uses his dribbles a lot as well to break lines rather than passes. So he's winning fouls, which means you retain possession anyway, or he's actually escaping the player trying to tackle him.
And fantastic calves too.
Yes, huge, massive calves. The final point I wanted to make is that if you reduce the chances created to 2 per 90 minutes, Bernardo Silva pops up. So already we've seen that three of Kevin De Bruyne's potential number 8 partnerships for Man City are all in this sort of safe creation zone where he can thrive in the chaos. And the final point of Bernardo Silva popping up means that Portugal are pretty much set to thrive in the chaos creation theory. So now that Liverpool fans have some ammo in response to any Twitter debates about their star playmaker, just remind Man United that they've got the exact same one. We're going to tie a bow in the Manchester Derby. History lesson, future planning, and really deep,
mathematics,
maybe pointless stat dive. And I'm going to be asking for what matters most. There's only one stat that matters most, and that's the scoreline. So, Mo, what will it be?
2-1 Man United. Harry Maguire with a big header at Vincent Kompany.
I always
did
laugh.
Did you ignore everything I just said, mate?
Exactly. I always laugh at Mo's predictions, and he always ends up being the closest. So I'm going to say it, but not actually respond. Sam?
I think 3-2 to Man City.
High scoring. Will?
I think 2-1 Manchester City. They've scored two in their last three visits to Old Trafford. And I've noticed in recent games, Man City have played well and perhaps not scored as many chances as they could have done. So I think the complexion of this game is going to be a sort of dominant City performance where they could have scored more, but it's actually going to be quite a close
result. City will dominate the game, but Harry Maguire, who went round Old Trafford talking to tea ladies and everything this week, is going to rise with the captain's performance. David De Gea is remembering how to save shots again.
Because they were creating loads of chances.
But he's kicking it into opposition players to directly go in the net.
probably
cancels it out.
Because the Sheffield Wednesday goalkeeper was probably a man of the match last night. And they only won 1-0. And also the cup final could have scored more than...
Yeah. Mahrez has been getting a lot of shots on target and not necessarily scoring. So he's one to look out for.
He's going to get Luke Shaw or Brandon Williams.
Who you've just said that Man United need to replace dramatically.
Absolutely.
But
yes,
there's motivation for Manchester United in the form of the fact that their season's a bit more alive, league table wise, and also they can do the double. They can do the double.
They want momentum heading into the Europa League as well. So. Mm.
So we have a mixture, two Man City scores versus one Man United, no draws. We're now going to move on to some just quickfire, some other Premier League games that may or may not find their way onto the Squawker Talker Betball Accumulator from this week. Remember, we'll put a link in, but you can download the app if you're 18 plus and you're gambling aware, where you can find our attempts to figure out the football fixtures in the Premier League usually. And there's also a new Betball market, which may be of interest, which is you can now predict how many defeats there will be for Liverpool in the Premier League, which is very interesting because obviously one last season, after all the talk of invincibles, maybe they'll even double it this time around. But we'll also go to Liverpool versus Bournemouth, and I'll ask you for predictions, but I'll start with a stat, and you can't change your predictions based on it. Liverpool have won their last five Premier League matches against Bournemouth by an aggregate score of 17-0.
Ooh. Yeah, but this Liverpool is different. I think 2-1, they'll just about sneak it, but they'll get a win, get back on track.
Sam?
Yeah, I think 3-1 to Liverpool.
2-0 Liverpool, but I think whoever Liverpool are going to be playing this weekend, they're going to be playing the most motivated version of that team. And I was going to, I don't think I was going to say this, but I had in my mind that Liverpool, I remember some tough games against Bournemouth recently.
Maybe, but 17-0 on the face of it.
It's pretty comprehensive.
Doesn't sound tough. Mohamed Salah also has a very good game. He scored in every game against Bournemouth. These are all courtesy of Opta stats as well. So we have plenty of ammo to predict that one. The next one that we've picked out to do a prediction is a team we also mentioned earlier, Spurs, looking to end their four-game winless run against the mighty Burnley.
It's going to be five games, mate. 1-0 Burnley.
Sam?
Well, Mourinho said in midweek about his Spurs players being physically dead. Yeah. So if you were going to pick one game that you didn't want to play after that, it would be Burnley away. And I think it's going to be a close game. But then, so Burnley have scored 27% of their goals in the final 10 minutes of matches. So if Spurs are leggy, then I think Burnley are going to score in the closing stages 2-1.
Everything we say always makes so much sense. and then it doesn't come to fruition.
Mourinho also said, I didn't see the direct quotes, but I saw a journalist for the BBC tweet about it. He said that he's going to tell the board that they have to choose a game to focus on out of the Burnley and the Leipzig game, which isn't how it works.
Yeah,
but it does sort of, I mean, and he's just saying that for show, but it doesn't...
It's never.
It doesn't fill me with confidence that Spurs are going to get their season back on track with a win here. Also, we were talking off air, Burnley are on the second longest active unbeaten run in the Premier League after Liverpool were beaten, longest belonging, of course, to Arsenal.
We've got our Arsenal back. Yeah. Is what I keep saying in retort to that.
So they're unbeaten in six games. And during that run, they've conceded just twice. I think they will concede against Spurs, but I think they'll also score against Spurs. So I'll go for 1-1.
1-1. The final, the penultimate game, sorry, that I have on this list is again featuring another FA Cup team, Chelsea versus Everton. Obviously, the return of Carlo Ancelotti. And it's the first time he's ever faced Chelsea in his career. So, which I found was interesting. I thought there'd be some sort of European fixture, intertwining of destinies. But no, his first return to Stamford Bridge with an Everton team that have scored in all 10 of their league games under Carlo Ancelotti.
I mean, if they let him on the bench, though, obviously he got sent off, didn't he? But I think...
He said, which I found quite funny, was that the seats are so close to the dugout anyway, I don't care. So, a man that knows Stamford Bridge well.
I think, 1-1, I think Chelsea don't play well at home, Liverpool game notwithstanding. I think they're... and Everton have Duncan Ferguson on the touchline, man. And those celebrations, he'll find a ball boy to hug. 1-1.
Every time that Chelsea have delivered a good performance this season, they seem to follow up with a bad one. And I've always sort of got carried away in the hype. So I'm going to back them this time to have a bad performance after a good one and lose 2-1.
On the basis of Sod's law, that has just convinced me to go the other way and predict a win. I was going to say the same. I make a similar-ish point by just making the observation that if they do win this, it could be a really big, big turning point for their season and really a vital time in terms of consolidating that top four spot. Because if they can demonstrate, you wouldn't maybe call it consistency, but if they can follow up a season highlight like the win over Liverpool with another really good performance, I think that's going to do wonders for their confidence getting back on track. The prediction I had, but I think Everton have also kind of been in good form, and I think this game's going to have quite a few goals. I'm going for 2-2.
Nice.
Oh, a scorecard.
It's classic.
We haven't had that in a while. Exactly.
It really is a big game in that top four, because if Man United lose to Man City and Chelsea lose to Everton, then it could open up for Wolves, because the goal difference is so close to go into the top four, and they've got Brighton, so...
Crazy. The Premier League table still hasn't been broken apart. Frank Lampard at the snooker table. failing to ever come to light. The final game to end this week's podcast.
You think there'd be one game where it would happen.
The final game that we are looking at is Leicester City versus Aston Villa. And I mentioned that Leicester themselves were... I had kept saying, oh, they're fine. They're going to definitely be one of the Champions League teams. Their form has dipped to an extent... that has drawn them back into will they, won't they finish in the top four, and they face Carabao Cup runners-up Aston Villa this weekend.
I think Grealish wins the battle of Madison. I think 1-0 Villa.
That'll be 3-0 to Grealish, wouldn't it? And Grealish Madison.
Ndidi made his first start for a month against Birmingham in the FA Cup. I don't think it's a fluke that Leicester have sort of struggled without him, so I think it's going to be 2-0 to Leicester, and it will go against Villa that they play on the Monday, having had to watch everyone else play. I think the pressure will really be on them if a couple of the other teams down there have picked up points over the weekend.
I think, but Bournemouth, is it Bournemouth immediately below them in the table? And they're never going to beat Liverpool.
because you mentioned that as well last week. Norwich must have thought, yes, 1-0 win against Leicester. What a result. We've finally... every other team around
is
getting a result. So... It's sort of, almost Leicester involved again. Their first last week, their last this week, and facing another relegation candidate. So they're having a big say in that race as well as the race for Champions League places. Will, did we get your one?
I'm going to go for 2-0 as well. As you touched upon, there's few teams in the Premier League in worse form than Leicester at the moment. But one of them is Aston Villa. They're technically going on five-game form. I think this will be payback for the semi-final. And it's as you also touched upon there, it's a big week for them because I've predicted other top four contenders to slip up.
But there's no
and drop points, Chelsea, and that could be them pulling away.
But it's not a cup game, so Ian Atcher won't score, and so who's scoring the goals then? Mm. That's the thing.
Jamie Vardy maybe returns.
One or two of the Leicester players.
Leicester posted that video of Jamie Vardy and Ndidi boxing each other, suggesting that they were approaching fitness. So maybe
they're
unleashed. Fighting fit and ready for a knockout blow against Aston Villa.